Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Rurkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we have, I will say, I think my most anticipated episode of the year, just because we are finally getting to talk about one of my, as of the last couple of years, new favorite directors. He's not new, but he directed films for nearly half a century. It's Akira Kurosawa. We are debuting our new series for season 6, and that's Frequent Cinematic Collaborators. So Akira Kurosawa worked with one of his actors, Toshirô Mifune, over 16 films. So we'll be talking about two of their collaborations, Rashomon, which has its 75th anniversary this year, and High and Low from 1963. A perfect movie, one of my favorites. I can't wait to talk about how his style changed over even just these years, these 13 years, and really their relationship and how that blossomed over time. It's going to be a great episode. How do you feel about Kurosawa just in general?
It's funny because I'm so excited for this episode, but I also feel nervous in the same way that I did when we talked about some of Hitchcock's biggest movies. Because, one, I feel like it's a long time coming. How have we not talked about Akira Kurosawa yet on the pod? When I watch his movies, I am just flabbergasted by the experience. And I think specifically with these two, what'll be exciting, I think, to talk about is just how influential both of these films have been on directors who are still working today. And I know he's known and he's recognized as one of the greats, but because we are an Oscars-themed show, there haven't also been a lot of opportunities to talk about him, which is unfortunate. And it makes you kind of think about how ridiculous the whole thing feels sometimes when you're not recognizing a director like Kurosawa for what I consider to be, I think, just two excellent films, great experiments in form also and style. And also, I think, if you're looking to get into Japanese cinema, or if Kurosawa is unfamiliar to you or you haven't seen any of his films, these two are really great starting points, I think, because they're just simply so enjoyable. Rashomon is only about 90 minutes long, and you get hooked instantly. And I think so many films and novels today have replicated the structure, which we'll talk about. And then with High and Low, you truly do not get better than this movie. Like, if you're thinking of the thriller genre, this movie is everything. So I know I'm hyping it up so much, but it's one of those films where you watch it and you just think this is absolutely immaculate. I wouldn't change a thing. So let's dive in, because I also think this collaboration is one of those director-actor pairings that isn't talked about enough. I think people, you know, they'll frequently point to De Niro and Scorsese as a key pairing, for example. But Kurosawa and Mifune, like you said, they had 16 collaborations from 1948 until 1965, from Drunken Angel to Red Beard. And Drunken Angel really put Mifune on the map. And he really became a movie star in Japan. He ended up winning the Volpe Cup twice under his direction for Red Beard and also for Yojimbo. So I'm excited, I think, to discuss this pairing, because in both of these movies, too, we get very different performances from him. They clearly had a really strong collaboration. And what we see in High and Low, I think, is the best performance of his career. So I'm glad we're kicking the series off with these two also. But we're also setting the bar very, very high.
I just have so much appreciation for his direction and style. And I have the High and Low Criterion Blu-ray, and I read through those essays. Just fantastic work. And the second one talks about Akira Kurosawa on set and how he functions and works with the actors during multiple rehearsals and really getting those rehearsals refined perfectly for filming, because they filmed on 35 millimeter and he liked to film in long takes, and those continue to get longer and longer. And many people like to say that he would have filmed longer if he could, but the film ran out. He could only film 1,000 feet at a time. Mm-hmm. And that was his limitation, not anything happening on screen. And that is really, I think, the key distinction of an auteur, that he knows what he wants. And over time that changes, but you see that vision really come to life. So mm-hmm. with all of that, Kurosawa also edited 14 of his own films, including these two that we're talking about today, and the only film that Mifune directed, called 500,000, which was also released the same year that High and Low was released, 1963. And you saying that High and Low is Mifune's best performance, it's so hard to, I think, clarify what best is, because it's a really great parallel to see him really young in Rashomon playing this villain to High and Low, where he's this business executive that we feel for. Mm-hmm. And so there are just so many varieties of what we get from him that I think can blend together, but are also so distinctive between his different movies. If we're talking like also Seven Samurai, and it is really wonderful. It is scary to talk about because they're really fun to dive into and get lost in.
I agree. And I was trying to think of, you know, what is it about Kurosawa's style that just stands out to me and that's always just drawn me in the way that it has. And it clicked for me in what you just said and in some of the research I was doing. I love a long take. I love when filmmakers take their time and make you sit with a certain image or a sequence in particular. And in reading about Kurosawa's childhood and how he came up as a director, what I really loved learning about him was that he had a deep love of art that was fostered by his relationship with his father. And it wasn't just Japanese art. In particular, he loved Dostoevsky. And if you think about the themes that are present in these massive Russian novels, they really come through, I think, in Kurosawa's films. This combination of darkness and pain and suffering and beauty at the same time. I think he's so good at fostering the connection between the two, and he's such a visual magician. And I learned that he was a painter too. And I think that just makes so much sense when you see his films. I think in particular, when we first walk into the forest in Rashomon, oh my God, it's glorious. It's like it's sparkling and you just want to stay there even though nothing is happening. And there are some shots too in High and Low where a character isn't saying anything, but we feel so much and we learn so much just in what's happening visually. And I think that that connects to his background as a painter and how he composes a shot. And I think the big thing also that you mentioned of him editing his films is so important, because he worked under a director named Kajiro Yamamoto. And when he worked for Yamamoto as an assistant director, he was trained in every aspect of the filmmaking process. He learned to edit. He learned to collaborate on scripts and do dozens of rewrites. He worked on the producing aspect of his films. And he really got, I think, this crash course in filmmaking as an assistant director. And he was able to, you know, work with his mentor and get that experience before then setting off on his own. And by that point, he had a clear visual style and he had a mastery of all of those different aspects of filmmaking. And I think you can feel that throughout all of his films, but I think especially the ones that we'll talk about today. And it's crazy because, like, we're not talking about Seven Samurai or Throne of Blood or, you know, any of these other, he's known for so many great films, but I think you can really feel that in these two.
His films are so timeless, and it comes back to what you're talking about. It's this deep sense of morality, of the human condition, of truth and memory that he can expose in his films and discuss them without having to narrate all of that along the way. So with some of his endings, they're left somewhat open-ended, or not necessarily abruptly, but it brings the conversation back to understand what he's showing you the entire time. And I think that's what I love is how many layers he has and how deep he goes with his storytelling to showcase his character development, why the scenery is so important, the angles, the camera movements, all of it goes together so, so well. So I think let's get started with Rashomon. Again, this came out in 1950. The description here, the rape of a bride and the murder of her samurai husband are recalled from the perspectives of a bandit, the bride, the samurai's ghost, and a woodcutter, the stars, Toshirô Mifune, Machiko Kyo, Masayuki Mori, and Takashi Shimura. Awards for this movie. So this was nominated at the Oscars in Best Art Direction, Set Decoration, Black and White, and it won the Honorary Foreign Language Film Award by the Board of Governors, the inaugural competitive award for Best Foreign Film or Best International Feature was given later in 1956. This was nominated at the BAFTAs for Best Film, known then as Best Film from any source. Kurosawa was nominated at the DGA. It won two awards at the NBR for Director for Kurosawa and Foreign Film, and it won the Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival. So you mentioned earlier on about the structure of this movie. Tell us more about that and why this was so influential at the time.
Yeah, so I first watched this movie actually in a film studies class in college. And it was one of those that I think is on many film studies class syllabi, but it doesn't feel academic. I think it feels just like a very simple story with an innovative structure. You have these two different accounts that feel woven together, yet that are different. And it's up to you to kind of figure out the details that are given to you visually. And you're not getting a lot of plot necessarily here, but you're experiencing the world of the film. And what's interesting is that these men are telling different stories of what happened to the husband in particular. They're telling different stories of what happened to this man, but they're all also claiming to be guilty. And then when the woodcutter gives his account, it's similar to the bandit who's played by Toshirô Mifune. But we can tell from this that there are just these different versions of the truth, or you think, what is the truth? But in particular, he's the one that we know is lying because the earlier version is different. So I think structurally, what's interesting is that the point of the film isn't that there is one central truth that we're supposed to discover. It's about how we experience and hear different stories and what a person's relationship to honor and the truth is, especially at that time and in Japanese society. But I think it's also then about subjectivity and your own perception of the truth. I know you like this movie a lot too. So when did you first watch it and how does the structure work for you?
I also first saw this in a college film class. I think many people do, but it's not boring in an educational sense. Like you said, it just has all of those elements that are so technically important that you can obviously see them being adapted since then. And I think maybe to viewers now, it doesn't seem so monumental, but at the time, having these four different perspectives told one after the other, where none of them are the same, it is really interesting because, again, you described how the truth doesn't really matter. It's listening to these stories and seeing maybe why they were lying, why they changed their story or shaped them how they did, and seeing the grand message of what does it all mean? When you have the woodcutter at the beginning, saying he found the dead samurai in the forest and then the wife's hat on a branch versus at the end when the priest is so upset with him because now we know that he's lied to him in telling the story. One, that shows us that we can't trust even the storyteller. But two, the way that he reconciles with the woodcutter's actions at the very end, when they find this baby, when the baby starts crying after the stories are told, that's what really shapes the meaning. And that's where the monk, like he says in his final lines, thanks to you, I think I can keep my faith in man. So it to me is more about the structure than us talking about each scene, which is really interesting. That's not usually how it goes. We usually go really in depth to a scene to try to figure out what they're telling us. But here it's the entire composition. And I think this is even different from High and Low. But that's again something that he transforms over his career, Kurosawa, in playing with style and form, yet still creating something that is so spectacular. And this not only inspired filmmaking, but the actual Rashomon effect. That's a name that lawyers use. And it's crazy to think that he had so much influence over other specialties and really just how people think in general. So that's really, I think, the basis for what's to come and why we think he's so incredible with his work.
Well, and I think to that point, what was so interesting to me too in reading about Kurosawa was that the actors in the film kept asking him what was the truth, what actually happened, and he wouldn't tell them. He said that that wasn't what mattered to the film. So I think just as humans, we naturally seek truth when things are contradictory and that don't make sense, especially, we think about these different accounts, right? We have four different witnesses, four different accounts. And then by the time when we get to the woodcutter and the woodcutter negates everything, you really, I think, at that point, don't entirely know. I love his final shots too. And, at the very end, when the rain stops and we get to, and we see the sun. First, I think it's important, right, that the baby crying is what interrupts the stories. I think, we're locked into them, and the fact that it's the baby crying that moves us to this deeper understanding of it, and then the clouds opening up to the sun when it is all said and done. And after that line that you read, I think that's another great Kurosawa moment where we don't have resolution. But he does show us some kind of resolution in it anyway. It's this ambiguous ending. And it reminded me, it made me think of when we just talked about Rebel Without a Cause, that contradiction of, and that feeling of, the end of the world coming at dawn instead of dusk. And at the end, we feel, some sort of hope and closure, but we also see the dawn. And knowing what James Dean's character just said, it carries a different meaning. And I think I felt similarly here with the ending of Rashomon. It's supposed to, I think, feel like this bit of closure because finally we have maybe some version of the truth in it that we should feel a certain way about these characters. But in reality, humans will always tell lies in their version of a particular story. I think we'll always have some way to benefit themselves. And their memories will never be 100% factually accurate. It's just not possible. And it really is when I think about films that have changed the direction of film history, the reason that it's taught in schools, like you were saying, it's not just because of specific scenes, it's because of that structure and how he's playing with structure and breaking the form apart from the very beginning.
Yeah, I love that connection to Rebel because I thought the same thing. When you hear the baby, it immediately changed to me. It's like, okay, the samurai died. We don't know where the wife went, potentially, but from his death comes life. And that, with the woodcutter and him taking the baby, I already have six babies. What's one more? And the hope that that instills in the monk is really what it's all about. And yeah, I love his storms in his films and how the end, we see that final shot of the sign over the city, Rashomon, once again. I will say my favorite moment or scene in the movie is when we get the samurai talking through the medium. This is also so interesting, I think, with just old Japanese culture and in honoring the dead. And I couldn't tell if it was the voice superimposed over hers, but it was just so spooky. And you see her conjuring him up and talking and the fright in her face and recounting the events that the samurai experienced, or his perspective. He's dead. He has nothing to lose. But again, you can't trust anyone, so you don't know what to think. But I think that full scene, I loved that he put that in there. It just feels so different from everything else that is so grounded in, I guess, the reality of the film of, you know, walking through the forest so slowly and capturing all of that light. And then we get this experience where we don't know what to believe. I mean, that's the entire film, but that was my favorite scene from the movie.
Yeah. Oh, I love that too. That would probably be my favorite scene too. And just to speak about Toshiro Mifune for a second, you know, I think in his role as the bandit, I think what's really cool about his performance here is also that we're getting essentially multiple versions of one character throughout the movie because of the structure, which is a really tall task, I think, for any actor, because they have to interpret that teller's version of who that character would be. And I think that that's a really cool detail and another thing to highlight just in his performance and his skills as an actor.
He feels so chaotic in this movie. Again, he's wielding a sword most of the time and antagonizing this couple. You see him crawling on all fours at one moment and trying to run from the samurai when they're fighting. So again, to see him this young and really acting so freely, I thought was really fun to see, especially, again, contrasted with what we'll talk about next in High and Low.
And if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
I really love the set design. I'm glad that it was nominated for that at the Oscars. Could we have included more? Obviously, I would say the one that I feel most inclined to give it to is to Akira Kurosawa. I think directing, you know, why not? But he was the editor, like I said, on this movie. And that's what I'm going to give it to him for. So influential. It's really what keeps you intrigued in this movie. And it never feels that segmented. These stories really flow one into another. And I think in other movies, especially when you're getting four perspectives, you're like, okay, we get it. Let's move on. Like, where are we going here? Yeah. It never feels like that. So I think in that sense, he absolutely deserves it. What would your one Oscar be?
I love that answer. And that's such a good point, because I always feel that in anthology films too, where when I know we're getting multiple accounts or we have multiple pieces of a story that we're going to experience, time tends to drag on. If you're told it's going to be told in so many parts, you just can kind of feel the length. But here, I never feel that. It just snaps you right into place. I think anytime, especially we go into the forest, he really does create that painterly, beautiful world that almost feels otherworldly. So then when you do, like you were talking about that scene with the medium, when you do get there, you just think, is any of this real? What is, you know? And that connects, of course, to the truth as well. But like I said, I like your answer, but I will go with Kurosawa for directing. I think just the influence that this film has is just undeniable. And that's totally his vision, you know, constructing the film in this way and creating something that is so precise and experimental, and yet he improves upon later, I think. So I would give it to him here. So let's move on to High and Low from 1963. Description here, an executive of a Yokohama shoe company becomes a victim of extortion when his chauffeur's son is kidnapped by mistake and held for ransom. This stars Toshiro Mifune, Yutaka Sada, Tatsuya Nakata, Hiyoko Kagawa, Tatsuya Mihashi, and more. This was nominated at the Golden Globes for foreign film and lost to France's Any Number Can Win, and it also screened at the Venice Film Festival. So we talked at the top, I think, about how much we love this movie, but what is it about High and Low that you really connect with, and what do you think makes it one of Kurosawa's best films?
I would say this is just one of my favorites and one of the best films, period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really everything. I saw this for the first time a few years ago in 2021 as a part of my Criterion Challenge for the year. Didn't know anything about it. And by the end of this movie, I was just totally awestruck by what I had watched. There's so much in the detail here. Kurosawa's form is so important, and what we see in the camera and how we see it. I really want to hear his opinions of Parasite, because I think there are a lot of parallels with that movie, and I couldn't not think about it from the very beginning when we have those shots out of the windows of the city to his kids playing cowboy and them shooting each other,
mm-hmm.
like the kids in Parasite playing. And then we see, again, High and Low, we're going down into the city. I love that the original title, or the Japanese title for this movie, is Heaven and Hell. Again, yeah. It's you see it on the poster of Toshiro playing Mr. Gondo and his wife looking through binoculars at the lower part of the poster where the police, the detectives, are hiding under a table. The symbolism is just beyond. And I think just the construction, how you feel about the characters, what you see along the way and how they interact, the fact that we get the kidnapper at one point face to face with Mr. Gondo and he doesn't know it. And then by the end of this movie, I think there's even more ambiguity than from Rashomon, because he's left alone. Mm-hmm. And every little thing just makes me so happy in this movie.
Yeah.
And here we get longer takes. We have 8-10 minute takes, and I don't even realize it. You know, looking back and reading essays, like, they talk about it, but you're just so invested in this movie that sometimes you don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the power of Kurosawa that really gets across so well, that this is easily my favorite, but also really wants me to keep checking out all of the other movies I haven't seen from him before.
Yeah. When you said this movie makes you happy, that's exactly, you know, how I feel watching it. You just get so sucked into every little detail, every long take. You know, I think the fact that this movie starts with the way that this movie starts, it makes you feel like you're going to be watching a corporate drama. Gondo, he is in what feels like a succession style battle for the shoe company. You know, he represents the good. He's very stubborn. He's very rich, but he wants to make high quality shoes. When he says that line about the hat being on top of the woman's head,
yep.
But the shoes supporting her weight, they need to be sturdy. They can't just be these cheap, low quality shoes. And the way that it starts, really, as this corporate tussle between these different factions, makes you think it's going to be one type of movie. And then all of a sudden, we get what is a very important shot, I think, and one that always makes me gasp. But it's when his son is playing cowboys with the chauffeur's son. And the way that Kurosawa's camera captures these boys, it is like they're in an old school epic Western, even though they're just playing with these toy guns at home. What that says to me also is just how violence plays a part in this movie, and it makes you think of power. It makes you think of violence, even though they're just playing a game, and how a duel like that will continue throughout the movie. And the way then that, right, we think the kids are playing in the other room, we're still stuck on the shoes. Like, we're very stuck on the shoe plot. That's what we're thinking about. And then when he gets the phone call that someone's kidnapped his son, June, they react the way any parent would when they hear the news that their child is kidnapped. And then the kid comes in the room and you're like, wait, what's going on here? But then also up to this point, you know these details about the money. You know the specifics of what he's going to do. He's told his plan to just a few people. And so then you're thinking, okay, well, did one of these guys who wants to take over the company orchestrate this? Is this part of this? Mm-hmm. Like, how is this all connected? But then, and it's so chilling, I think, when June is like, oh, but Shinichi isn't here. And you find out that they kidnapped the chauffeur's son by mistake. So then what happens is you talked about morality at the beginning of the episode. It introduces this great what if question of what would you do in that case? Because suddenly the stakes are lowered. It's not his kid anymore. So it becomes, you know, this idea of, you know, you have this ransom money that he's supposed to pay this person to get the kid back. But he has this dilemma now of my company, my livelihood, or this kid that's not even mine. And that's such a great dilemma that he creates. And it's completely different than what you think this movie is going to be about from the first scene.
That's what locks you in, is not saying, oh, how much would you pay to get your own son back? It's how much would you pay? What would you sacrifice? Would you sacrifice your entire career for somebody else's family? Mm-hmm. Anybody. It doesn't have to be their kid, but that idea in itself is enough for an entire movie, probably longer than this one. And it's what intrigues you to keep watching to see, will he pay? Won't he pay? Because I think anyone watching would say, probably not.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, but you know, it's that is your life. But to see what he goes through, and that is definitely part of Mifune's performance of what I enjoy is the back and forth, the internal struggle you see in his face, the fear in those phone conversations with the kidnapper calling, not knowing what's going to happen, and understanding that he could lose really his life through this situation. And the fact that the detectives get that makes you feel for him even more. And they're trying to help him so much that they want this criminal to get the worst penalty possible. And so do we for what he's done to this family, really all of these families, and the situation with the shoe company, because we know his coworkers don't care about anything but money. Hey, you put your share with us and we'll kick the old guy out. And then later in the movie, hey, we're going to work with the old guy and kick you out. It's like they don't care about him or the kid. I mean, that is what's frustrating, but so true about business executives. And it brought back this idea to me of Luigi Mangione.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
How the people in the city. And they're like, we see that house on the hilltop more and more. It makes me feel like the kidnapper. And that quote just, oh my God, it sends chills down my spine, because you start to understand why someone would have done something like this, even though we never hear from the actual kidnapper and why. Yes, we think it's maybe one of the executives, but that also feels too easy. So yeah, it's bringing it back to modern day. And what I was initially saying is they're helping him. And the lead investigator says, but we can't arrest him now. He'll only get 15 years, and Gondo is serving a life sentence for his debt. And those are the stakes. And so you want this conclusion to live up to that. And I think it totally does. And you're just waiting on pins and needles to get there. And Kurosawa does everything right to keep that intrigue at a 10 until the very end.
Oh, yeah. And I think there are really a couple of really interesting details that Kurosawa introduces early on about social mobility and the idea of this, which comes up in this film. And like you mentioned, Parasite, I think that would be a great double feature with this. So the first is, it's the chauffeur's kid who accidentally is kidnapped, right? Like, he's the one who's also punished. And I don't feel like this character is treated really with enough care at the beginning, right? The conversation, if you think of it, is all about Gondo. It's all about his money. It's all about, you know, what could come of this, the ransom. But when you think about it, another man's kid has just been kidnapped and there's nothing he can do, right? He can't pay the money. He can't assist in this way. And he's just a victim of circumstance. The other piece, there are two other things. One, the fact that the police come into their home disguised as delivery workers.
So good.
It's just like a brilliant detail. I'm obsessed with that. I think it's perfect. And the line about Gondo, when he's talking to his wife and she's like, I'm okay, I can do this. We don't need this money. I can live without it. I can live a life without luxury. And he's like, no, you can't. You can't do this. You don't know what it's like. I know what it's like. And the line later about him really only being successful in a shoe company, partially because of his wife's dowry and her family money. So he just is incorporating all these little details about money and social class and how difficult it is to move up and how that really can be a myth anyway, without just the full support and help of the rich, is really unique. And then I think what's interesting about the story too is once we move away from Gondo for a little bit, we actually spend so much time with the detectives in the investigation. And I love that. I couldn't help but think of how much David Fincher probably loved this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because we spend so much time. But to me, I eat it all up. Like, I love the press conferences and when they're in the room talking about the details and how they're getting closer and closer and closer to finding this guy. And in the end, he turns out to be completely unrelated from the shoe company at all. And that's what I really like about it. It's not related to this introduced plot at the beginning. That is, of course, that affects how we feel about Mifune and his performance and that character. But the actual criminal is someone completely different. And that, I think, is what I really also like about it.
And this is how Kurosawa brings in editing in the movie. He uses white cuts, which I love. It has that old Hollywood feel. Not really anything we see today, but that's how he passes time. And I love how details come about, whether it's with conversations with the criminal and how he doesn't want to always just have us on the phone over and over. When he calls, he'll have one phone call and then we'll be listening to the recording for the next one. Mm-hmm. He switches things up. And he also does this with plot details of wipe cut. We see newspaper articles and their titles of all police units mobilized, national shoes exec throws fortune out the window. And I love this because we're learning about what's happening. Time is passing. A lot of time is passing. And then it turns out that the kidnapper is the one showing us the newspaper. So it introduces this character really well partway through the movie. And this also introduces us to a different perspective of the detectives trying to figure out where this person is. But now we see it and it all makes sense. And I think this is a great way to bring in his framing and how he works with his cinematographers, because through his back window, we see the house on top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of windows framing people or scenarios in this movie. Door frames, glass, people looking back and forth at each other. And it's just a great way that he highlights what he wants us to be looking at.
I really love that too. And I also like the idea of how what Gondo does, you know, if he makes the right decision of saving this kid, even though he might lose his company, oh, wait, the public will look upon you favorably. And that will benefit you in your career long term. So it's still like there aren't completely altruistic motivations here. Like people are still thinking about this in relation to business. And when we're thinking about the kidnapper and, you know, you mentioning those beautiful shots and I think the high and low of it all, I want to read my favorite quote from the movie because it perfectly encapsulates the idea of why someone might do this and why someone might feel driven to do this. But the kidnapper, when he's face to face with Gondo, says, "Day by day, I came to hate you more. It gave me a reason for living." And when you hear that,
scary.
It's so scary. It's so random, right? Just someone seeing that house up on the hill, envisioning a different life, a life that they know they can't have, how that drove him to be motivated to carry out this horrific act.
Yeah, it's the hate for the rich, and that's what it comes back to. There's another quote. "It's amusing to make fortunate men taste the same misery as the unfortunate."
Mm-hmm.
"We're fighting over 50 million yen. Meanwhile, we are dragged into the literal hell of this city where these drug addicts are floating around like ghosts. Seeing these people come around just looking for their next fix, they have no hope. They're all laying around, and then Takahiro, the criminal, kills one. And it's almost like nothing has happened."
Yeah.
So the juxtaposition of those scenarios, or of, you know, how we start to feel more and more for Gondo, but also realizing the socioeconomic landscape of the city, of the people in the city, we're living it. And it's interesting how Kurosawa frames all of that, or again, uses editing to show the differences between those situations and the meaning behind it all.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable film. We could definitely keep going about it, but I think that at least scratches the surface and gets into quite a few of the themes, I think. And I think it's safe to say we highly, highly recommend this movie. It's on the Criterion Channel. It's such a beautiful film and just one that really sticks with you. Especially if you like crime thrillers or procedurals, you will love this one.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a movie for anybody because of its themes, its beauty. We didn't even talk about the Schindler List moment when that happens.
Yeah.
It's like Kurosawa is defying every odd. It feels like such a fresh movie. Mm-hmm. And then he surprises you near the end. And you're like, what? You did this?
Yeah. You were watching a black and white movie, and then all of a sudden you see a little bit of pink. It's crazy. It really does throw you in the best way.
It's, yeah, beautiful. So, yeah, highly recommend both of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I feel like we need to talk about more of his movies.
Yeah.
I guess with that, I don't know if we will this season, but are there others that you would recommend? I know you briefly mentioned Red Beard at the end of last week's episode.
I will recommend Throne of Blood. That's my other favorite, I would say, besides High and Low. So what's it? And it also stars Toshirô Mifune. What I like about this movie is that this is Kurosawa's retelling of Macbeth. Many directors have tried Shakespeare. But what he does that's so cool, I think, in this movie is it's very violent. It really understands, I think, the themes of the text. But he also sets it in feudal Japan, which is just a completely different way to reimagine the story. And even if you're not a fan of Shakespeare, or if you think Shakespearean adaptations tend to be stuffy or like costume dramas, this is not that. It feels like very relevant and timely. And of course, is just executed flawlessly. So I would recommend Throne of Blood. What about you?
He has so many greats. I am going to say Akiru, which is what the recent film Living was based on and what Bill Nighy earned his Best Actor Oscar nomination for. The films are fairly similar in plot, but there's something just extra special about seeing Kurosawa's direction and how he plays with that character. Another one of his favorite actors he works with, Takashi Shimura, is also in this movie playing that character, and it's just deeply moving. again, his character development and studies just really makes you feel the human connection underneath the struggles that his characters are going through. I also mentioned my recent Western watches. I haven't seen Yojimbo yet, but the connection there is that when Sergio Leone released his Fistful of Dollars, Kurosawa actually sued him. He said it was a fine movie, but it was my movie. And he won that lawsuit, but that's what Yojimbo is. So I really need to watch that. And then Sanjuro is a sort of sequel to that, which you can see in parts of For a Few Dollars More, which I really love. So I am very curious about those two movies. But yeah, so many adaptations. He creates these timeless stories. You really can't go wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I am going to be scouring the internet for rep screenings of Kurosawa films because now I feel like I'm on a kick and just need to watch more because there are quite a few that I haven't seen also. But I know I'm just going to go to high and low. The second I see that's playing somewhere, I'm just going to drop everything and go see that. But we also, you know, did this episode in part because Highest to Lowest is coming out later this summer, early fall. So we'll definitely talk about that and Spike Lee's reimagining of High and Low later this year. But I thought this was really fun. I'm so glad we also had an excuse to talk about these movies and also have our first episode in our frequent cinematic collaborator series be on Toshirô Mifune and Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah, I love this. I love that many of you submitted recommendations for future episodes in this series. So we're checking those out. We are trying to figure out which ones we should cover, also based on anniversaries for the year. I love the connection with Spike Lee's movie. And I think Denzel is maybe the only actor that can represent such an iconic performance. And that's premiering at Cannes, where you are currently. So next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll have a Cannes update. I am so excited. I wish I was there with you. But you'll be seeing so many new releases, and I can't wait to hear about them. Movies that, like we've seen in past years, we talk about during Oscar time and award season. So I hope there's some good ones out there for you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited. I can't wait to see what's here. I'm so excited for, I think, Sentimental Value. That is a big one on my list. Die My Love. Oh my gosh, so many movies. But yeah, I'm really eager to check out Highest to Lowest, of course. And yeah, we'll share an update soon on our next episode about these movies. Thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. And for bonus content, you can find us at patreon.com/OscarWilde.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.